Mini episode 46 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by the Pullins Group, delivering public affairs consulting and marketing services for small businesses trying to grow. Follow them on the web at PullinsGroup.com.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Welcome to another mini episode of the FDH Lounge, hosted here by Sportsology on their channel, and very grateful to them for doing so, for our good friend Russ Cohen for throwing open the doors for us yet another time here. The FDH Lounge, the program where nothing is off topic. Good evening, everyone. I'm FDH Managing Partner Rick Morris. I'm going to be joined shortly by two very special guests as we discuss here this evening the unfortunate, and I guess that would be a tremendous understatement, the tremendously unfortunate set of events at Penn State and at Syracuse, two schools that are joined, quite frankly, by shame right now as the youth molestation scandals have swirled around both schools, as they have other institutions in past years, from the Catholic Church to some other places. This plague has now visited intercollegiate sports, and we're going to get some great perspectives here tonight from some gentlemen who are really plugged in on this. Football journalist Ken Palmer of Giant Insider is very close to the situation at Penn State as an alum. He's remained very plugged into everything that has happened over an extended period of time. We've got him on with us. We've also got our good friend Steve Callis, FDH Lounge dignitary and a multi-platform personality here, a terrestrial radio, cable TV, and the Internet between WVOX, WFAN, SNY in New York, and our old stomping grounds with the FDH Lounge, the Sports Talk Network. We'll predominantly be getting some thoughts from Ken on the front end here, because I know we've got him for a limited availability. We may try and get a redirect on one of his thoughts, possibly from Steve, and maybe get a little bit of interaction here. But I know we've got Ken for only a limited period of time, and we're sensitive to that. So let me bring them both in. We've got Ken Palmer here in the lounge. Ken, good to have you on, my friend. How are you tonight?
Real good, Rick. Good to be on with you, as always, buddy.
Thank you, my friend. Good to have you back in. And Steve Callis also. Counselor, how are you doing tonight, my friend?
I'm doing well. Great to be with both of you. I know you have a limited time, Rick, so we can get right to it.
I know we've only got Ken for a couple minutes here, but Ken will start with it. And, again, your thoughts as this thing's been developing. I know that obviously there was a lot of shock, certainly denial in some quarters over the first part of this scandal. It seems to me there's a parallel that comes to mind in my head, and I can't get past the fact that Joe Paterno was fired 22 years to the day after the Berlin Wall fell, almost to the hour. And if you look at the last couple of days, I'm not comparing anybody to East German dictators, but if you look at the series of events in both places, it's just shocking how quickly things manifested. And when one case the Berlin Wall falls, and another case a vaunted coaching institution falls, but how did you see everything coming together in those days and some of the events that have happened since then? What's been your thoughts and your perspectives on this?
Well, that's quite a comparison, Rick. I didn't know that one, nor had I heard that one before. But, I mean, initially, just shock. I'm actually still in shock over the whole Sandusky thing. I knew the guy pretty well when I was out there, and never in a million years would I have seen it coming. The way just the dominoes fell were surprising as well. You know, when you first hear the news, okay, well, it's absolutely terrible, but you're kind of thinking it's an isolated incident. And then next thing you know, heads are rolling and everyone's fallen. I'm sure I'm in the minority here. I know I'm not unbiased here, but I think the Paterno thing was handled terribly. And I'm not comparing the two situations because obviously the Penn State one is a lot more extreme than the Syracuse one, but Syracuse has wisely taken a wait-and-see approach, whereas Penn State took a we're-going-to-bow-to-public-pressure approach, And they just fired the guy immediately on the spot. And a lot of people have come out since and said, you know what, maybe they did act too soon. Maybe, you know, maybe they should have let this thing play out. Maybe he didn't know as much as we all thought he knew. So to me, that's the sad part of it. The sickening, shocking part is Sandusky. And it's hard to think he's innocent at this point with everything that we've seen and heard and all the corroboration. But to me, the sad thing is the way that the university just showed so little loyalty and faith in Paterno and just canned him immediately. That's what's still keeping me up at night and kind of sticking in my craw.
The one thing I would hope we could all agree on is some real distaste for the leak that came out yesterday when the leak came out from the Penn State Athletic Department to Sports by Brooks saying that Joe Paterno is in terrible health and this might be his last Christmas. That's incredibly distasteful for them to do, to violate his privacy in this way. And I would hope everybody could agree, regardless of your feelings on other things with the situation here, that nobody deserves to be dehumanized in that kind of a manner. As far as the situation went, I'd like to get your thoughts as somebody who had been through State College, very close to it still, the national perception of State College and everything in the days that came after that. You had the students that night with their little rally slash whatever you want to call it, some might say riot, about Paterno being fired. You had that press conference where I thought a lot of the locals, quite frankly, were being horribly unprofessional with the Board of Trustees and some of the questions that they were asking, and really a homeristic type nature, it seemed like. It just seemed like the gravity of the situation of child abuse was lost on a lot of people there. The community itself really seems to have taken a black eye over the period of time as this happened, and I'd like to get your thoughts on that, on how much of it you think is deserved.
Yeah, no question. I mean, to me, Rick, and I'm a member of the media, as are all three of us here, but to me, I was absolutely just sick over the media handling of the situation, in that those weren't riots out at Penn State the night Paterno was fired. A couple kids overturned a truck. That was the extent of it. And I know from someone that was there that cameramen were trying to incite the crowd because they were out there to see riots. These cameras and these dopes holding the microphones were out there to see riots, and when they didn't see riots, they tried to start their own riots. The other thing that made me absolutely sick and has gone unreported was there was supposedly a bomb threat the night before the Nebraska game, started by the media, of course. There was no bomb threat. I actually was able to confirm without a shadow of a doubt there was no bomb threat. So here you have the media making themselves the story. And that's what they wanted to do. They want it to be mayhem. They want it to be riots. They want it to be bomb threats, whether they're there or not. That's what the media wants, so that's what the media gets. So to me, that stood out, and that's something I don't think a lot of people realized, you know, the way it was portrayed. As far as the press conference, yeah, Rick, there's no question. That was horribly unprofessional. But they let students in, not even students that were members of the media. There were actually just students off the street in there. And why they were in there is beyond me. That was just an error. You know, that was just a big-time error to allow that. But it's just the isolation is, you know, of the Penn State community has long since, you know, been kind of a source of pride in Happy Valley and kind of something that's rubbed everyone else the wrong way. And to me, here was a good chance to kind of blow it up. And it did. I mean, it was blown up by their own doing, but here was the media shot to kind of blow it up even more so, and that's what they did. And some of the acts, and I'm not going to name actual names, but I know who they are, and believe me, I'll have something to say to them next time I see them. Some of the acts of the individual members of the media during this whole thing were just absolutely disgusting, guys.
Yeah, well, something tells me that some of them might have four letters on their network blazer, but that's just my guess anyways, educated or otherwise. Before I get a final thought from you in your remaining time, Ken, Steve, let me throw it to you just for a quick thought here on what Ken said. Any instances you've seen of where the media coverage of this has been especially egregious in your mind?
Well, I did watch the press conference, but I think Ken made some fascinating points about the media. You could probably do a whole show on that in and of itself, because it is true it's almost network news to some degree coming to life, and we're finding this more and more. But those instances that Ken just talked about, some of which are news to me, quite frankly, is really an interesting aspect. But I'd rather get back to the whole Joe Paterno thing, because the thing that troubled me the most, and I'm totally with the program in terms of, I'm not a Penn State guy, but I'm totally with the program in terms of what he did for the university. But it always gets back to the Watergate question, fellas. What did you know? When did you know it? And everyone was trying to sift through what Joe Paterno knew and when he knew it. And right now, to me, the difference between Paterno and Boeheim is, at a minimum, Joe Paterno knew something bad happened in 2002. And the interesting legal aspect there, fellas, is McQuarrie apparently went to the grand jury and said, I told Joe Paterno everything in graphic detail. And Joe Paterno went into the grand jury and apparently said, oh, he was talking about some maybe fondling or horsing around, or I'm not sure. And those are two divergent stories and very important. The other issue from a knowledge perspective for Joe Paterno, which I think is what led to his firing, rightly or wrongly, is back in 1998, there's that police report from the Penn State police, which nobody believes Joe Paterno did not see. Apparently, he said he didn't know anything until 2002. And, of course, everyone knows now about the supposedly closed practice in 2007, where Sandusky, after he was no longer an assistant, after he was barred from bringing children to Penn State, supposedly showed up at a closed practice at Penn State with a kid. Hard to believe Joe Paterno didn't see that. So there is at least a stream of things which would lead to some kind of knowledge for a very long period of time. The flip side, and I think what Ken is referring to, is he did do what he was supposed to do under the law. Technically correct. So is that enough? I think as a lawyer you could make a great case that that was enough and he should not have been fired.
Very interesting. And Ken, I guess that's where I'd like to start by getting your final thoughts on this here tonight. In terms of where the program goes from here, the legacy of what happened, and hopefully it's not minimizing the situation or trivializing it for me to ask, you know, a football-related question along these lines. But I think we're all fascinated culturally by where this goes from here, what the reckoning is, the next coach that comes in, how big of a house cleaning there is. And not to be morbid, but the question comes to mind, if Joe Paterno doesn't have long left on this earth, does that sort of airbrush things a little bit? If anybody is too upset about this, it's harder to be upset at somebody who's deceased. It's harder to hold a grudge. What do you think some of the ramifications are going forward? I know that nobody really knows, but as somebody who's so plugged into it, what are your thoughts?
Well, just to start with the health situation, people kind of claim that, wow, you know, this thing went down and then the Paterno camp kind of leaked out that he was sick, looking like, you know, he was looking for sympathy. And it couldn't have been more opposite from the truth. He knew he was sick a week or so before any of this went down, didn't want it known, then especially did not want it known after this went down. And then they got wind that enough people knew about it and were going to blow it out. So that's why they said, okay, let's at least let this information out on our own, you know, under our own power, so to speak. So that's another thing that really has bothered me, is they're making it look like, wow, this guy, you know, he's trying to cover up all this craziness by saying he's sick now. He knew he was sick. He didn't want it out. And if none of this had gone down, we probably still wouldn't know that he was sick at this point. That's just kind of how he operates. But, you know, just when the thing went down, I mean, to me, it on one hand, it showed all that was right about society when you saw the kids and, you know, they're raising money and Penn State's going to donate money. But on the flip side, you had just people tripping over themselves to be more politically correct than the next person, and let's for the kids this and let's that, and you have all these idiots on TV for the kids, for the kids, for the kids. And to me, it just made people look so stupid. It just made our world of followers. Our world is just full of followers. There's not enough leaders, and you just saw it. And I am. I'm talking about big-time people on ESPN, big-time people on NBC. These idiots they were tripping over themselves to be more for the kids than the next guy. If Rick says for the kids twice, well, then Ken has to say it three times, and Steve has to say it four times. It became a competition over just a tragic situation. And that obviously has me bothered, as you could tell. But real quick, just going forward, it's going to be hard to get a coach. I mean, they'll get a coach, but they wanted Urban Meyer. Everyone knows they wanted Urban Meyer, and if this hadn't gone down, they were very well might have gotten Urban Meyer, but he wants nothing to do with this, and I don't blame him, and who would it? It would have been hard enough to follow Paterno as it is, but now you're following Paterno in this type of situation. I mean, it's going to hurt recruiting. It's going to hurt just the program going forward. So I keep hearing Mullen. I'm sure you guys have as well, Mississippi State. But, I mean, as a Penn State alum, am I excited about Mullen? No, of course not. I mean, I barely heard of the guy when the name first popped up. So the ramifications are just they're just starting. It's just going to get worse and worse. I mean, and not just for prospective athletes going to Penn State. As a kid, as a junior in high school, or, you know, if you were thinking Penn State, as much as this doesn't affect you, you think, well, maybe let me just go somewhere else. There's just such a bad connotation with the name right now. And to me, it's sad because Paterno did so much for so long to build up a correct reputation, and it came crumbling down, just like Rick said earlier, you know, with the Berlin Wall, it's same type of situation. So it's a tragedy. There's no question. And obviously the kids are the ones most affected, but I'm not going to go on and on and on for the kids like everybody else, because then I'd be a hypocritical moron like most people.
Well, buzzwords are the enemy of great conversation. We know we can always get great conversation from you, Ken. I'll leave you with this. It's not a very happy thought. You know it's a brave new world for your alma mater when you're getting big time by the head coach of the University of Virginia. That's not a good sign.
No, I know. And it's funny, you heard – you know, just different guys. I mean, Al Golden was a guy that would have killed for the job 5 years ago, and now he's not interested. The Rutgers guy, Schiano, you know, I mean, it's going to be interesting. And to me, you know, it's just, you know, whoever they get, I'm not going to be happy with. I could tell you that right now. Once Meyer signed on the dotted lines in Columbus, I'm not interested in whoever else they get at this point, guys.
Well, it's pretty bad when Al Golden would rather deal with the aftermath of boats and hoes than go into a Penn State to deal with that. So we'll have to see how it goes. But, Ken, always a pleasure, my friend. Looking forward to having you back in the FDH Lounge sometime soon.
You bet, fellas. Stay well. Be good.
Thanks, pal. Good to have you on. All right, our good friend Ken Palmer from Giant Insider. Good to have him on here tonight. Steve, something that had come up. Just sort of briefly there, as we were talking about some of the legal things in just a loose kind of a way and talking with Ken, I've been dying to ask you ever since this broke, what would you, as a man of the bar, have to say about a lawyer who would allow his client to go on and get vivisected the way that Jerry Sandusky did by Bob Costas?
You know, I got to say, it's just so bizarre, and people talk about 15 minutes of fame, and this Amendola is getting his now, but it just doesn't make sense. Now, again, he was questioned as recently as yesterday about this whole, I don't even know what to call it, procedure, process, ability to try and do something for his client. He said he has no regrets about anything he's done so far, and that he has a plan. The problem is no one can really figure out what the plan is. Certainly Jerry Sandusky has not helped himself. Just, you know, when they tell you don't say anything, get a lawyer, keep your mouth shut, anything you can say can and will be used against you. Well, just look at the answer to the Bob Costas question. You know, are you sexually attracted to young boys? And that pause that was probably a second or two, but seemed like an hour. And then the 30-second answer before he said, no, I'm not. So, I mean, just in and of itself, if you played that tape for somebody, like a juror, I don't think they're going to really quite believe anything the guy says. And, again, supposedly Amendola has a plan, but if he does, none of us can figure it out. Now, some people have hypothesized that he's going to try and make a case that his client is insane. But I'm not even sure you would make that case with Bob Costas on national TV. You're going to have to get three experts to say the guy's crazy. I don't know if you can do that or not. And I got to tell you, he doesn't seem crazy to me. He seems in like 100% total denial. I will say there's one other thing, though. During that interview, the Costas interview, and everybody gave Bob Costas great marks, and, hey, he's Bob Costas, he's a great interviewer. But in one sentence, Jerry Sandusky said the following, in one sentence, Rick, I've showered with boys, I've hugged boys, I've touched their legs, not in a sexual way. That was in one sentence. The next question then has to be, if you had a prosecutor there or a lawyer, I think the next question would have been, okay, you just said you've taken showers with a boy and you hugged boys. Did you hug a boy in the shower? You touched him on his leg. Did you touch him on his ankle? Or did you touch him on his thigh? In other words, it could have even been worse than it was, and I think it was pretty bad. So, no, I have not figured out the plan. I'm surprised. I'm not going to jump on the guy like every other lawyer in America has, because it's like beating a guy while he's down. If he has some master plan, nobody can figure it out. So my sense is, frankly, that there is no master plan. If you're trying to make this guy a sympathetic guy, that hasn't worked. If you heard about the letter today that his wife wrote, I don't know if you heard about it yet, it just came out today, open letter from Jerry Sandusky's wife, thanking all their friends for sticking by them. Now, I don't know who's sticking by him. I have not heard one guy stand up for Jerry Sandusky. I mean, because if you read the grand jury presentment, that 23-page document, which you can find online anywhere, it makes you sick to your stomach, Rick. So I don't understand the plan. I don't really think there's a plan. I don't think he's going to try and say the guy is insane. Certainly, if you were going to do that, you wouldn't go about it this way, frankly. So I must say I'm a little, I can't figure it out. So do I think it was a big mistake? Absolutely.
Yeah, I think so. And a couple things came to mind about what you just said. One, it looks like the only guy who's bucking for an insanity plea is the lawyer himself. That doesn't do the client any good by letting him go on there and do that. Second of all, if you know that when your client is asked if he's a kid toucher and you're going to get 30 seconds of humming a humming a humming a humming a, yeah, might not be a good idea to let him go on there in the first place, but what do I know? I'm not a man of the bar myself. I'm just a legal layman here.
I think a lot
here,
of this is common sense. Certainly you have a lot of that, Rick. Again, it's just it's befuddled people. Again, the only thing I remotely heard that could be an explanation is that he's going to have him plead insanity, not guilty by reason of insanity. But I personally don't even think that's going to fly.
No. I wouldn't think so either. Moving more towards media ethics and the like, what do you think about the situation here with, as we look at Syracuse, ESPN, again, they claim they did something with the tape years ago of Mrs. Bernie Fine, but having this thing recorded back in 2002, and it's only coming out now. Mark Schwartz has been out there doing a lot of damage control, but it doesn't appear to be doing any good. And from an ethical point of view, I got to say, again, as a layman in these matters, it really doesn't look good for them at all to have been sitting on this thing all that time.
Well, the Post Standard, which was the newspaper whose reporters apparently encouraged Bobby Davis to actually go and make this tape, which is a whole other interesting thing, actually wrote like a 4 or 5 page defense of themselves as to why they didn't do it. And, of course, the good thing, I think, for ESPN and the Post Standard is that neither of them went with it, so they could say, hey, we both came to the same conclusion separately. On the one hand, that's kind of good. And nobody thinks that tape would ever see the inside of a courtroom. That's all true. But from a going-forward perspective at the time, I listened to that tape, you listened to that tape. I mean, it's another sick tape. I mean, all you keep saying in this case is, man, this stuff is sick, in the Bernie Fine case and in the Sandusky case. But specifically with the tape, I read the defense that the Post Standard said, and they came up with there was no second guy at the time, there was no this, there was no that, there was no corroborating evidence. What would happen, how would you feel if it was you and it might have destroyed your life? And you know what? That's not so bad as far as it goes, but here's the problem with that. What happens if it was you and then it destroyed other people's lives? So I would write one more sentence if the song would be objective. The objective would be, what was happening versus how many lives were destroyed? And we don't know the answer to that. Could be zero, could be one, could be two, could be 20. We don't know it. Like today we don't know. But how many lives could have been saved if something had happened? The Sandusky case is better because if someone stopped him in 98, or 2000 when the janitor saw him in the shower, or 2002 when the query saw him in the shower. You know, 5 or 10 or 15, there's already 22 victims who have come forward in the Penn State case. So that's obviously a little farther along. But I think that would have been enough for me not to bring indictment, but in terms of corroborating evidence, which is what they were talking about, it seems to me that was pretty much good corroboration. That at a minimum, Rick, Bernie Fine was doing some bad things to multiple kids.
He was. No question about that. The thing that both cases seem to have in common is that it was a bad combination of, in some instances, people looking the other way or covering things up, but a lot more people doing just the legal minimum and covering themselves and saying, well, what do you want from me? I did this or I did that. And legally they're okay, morally maybe another thing. I'd like to bring it around because I think this is a perfect exemplification of that, and it's very similar as far as the other situation. Jim Boeheim. Now, I don't care what the flow charts say about he answers to the AD, who answers to the president. Jim Boeheim pretty much runs Syracuse. So this notion here, it struck me. I know it's not the legal definition of witness intimidation, but the way he came out right out of the gate, I was calling for his head. And subsequently, he's apologized, and I guess I'm willing to soften my stance on that. But what do you think of a situation like that where he's out there, he's going far beyond defending Bernie Fine, but it's becoming a thing of, oh, anybody that comes forward's a bunch of money-grubbing scumbags. Legally or not, as far as the definition goes, that sure smells like witness intimidation to me.
Well, there's no question he went over the top initially. And the thing that I'll say in his defense, because as we talk right now, the same question for Jim Boeheim was the question for Joe Paterno, which was answerable to some degree. The question for Jim Boeheim is, what did he know and when did he know it? Now, he knew of the allegations back in 2005, but he can easily fall back on the fact that ESPN looked at it, the Syracuse Post-Standard looked at it, the Syracuse Police looked at it, Syracuse University looked at it, and all came to the same conclusion. As you know, the feds are now investigating the investigation to see if it was a sham investigation, but you're not going to get away from the fact, rightly or wrongly, that both ESPN and the Post-Standard didn't go forward with the story based on the tape, which, by the way, somehow the police in Syracuse and Syracuse University didn't get at the time. Bobby Davis made some kind of, I'll take it to the media, but I won't take it to the authorities' decision, which in retrospect is a very poor decision, frankly. But I think overall, the problem for Boeheim, I still don't know the answer. To me, Boeheim was being loyal. You can go that way. But what did he know and when did he know it? Is it like none of us can really believe, now Paterno definitely had knowledge, but none of us can really believe that Paterno didn't know about it in 1998. He knew about it for sure in 2002. He had to be at the close practice in 2007 unless they can prove he wasn't. To me, that's a pattern over 9 years. Now, with Jim Boeheim, though, who according to other coaches, that Boeheim never goes to their hotel room, he never went to a Bernie Fine hotel room. He was defending a loyal friend. He was being loyal to a friend of 50 years. I can still buy all that. I would not call for his firing until somebody shows me that he knew something or saw something. And I think even Bobby Davis said he never saw Boeheim when he was with Fine, for example. But Bobby Davis was a ball boy, for example, as you know. And the whole Mike Lang thing, the second guy who was Bobby Davis' stepbrother, he first denied anything had happened. That was part of everybody's investigation in 2005. He was not the corroborating witness back then that he was 2 weeks ago. And now the third guy, and I do have an article up at SportsTalkNetwork.com, I wrote a few weeks ago, the Pennsylvania State Court might be the place to go, because in Pennsylvania, as opposed to New York, the victim, you can be indicted for child abuse until the victim's 50. Now, this is Zach Tomaselli, he's only 23, but his story is kind of falling apart, as you've probably heard. Did he travel with the team? Did he not travel with the team? Now, given all of that, I still can't answer the question, what did Jim Boeheim know and when did he know it? Because I haven't heard any evidence, unlike him with Paterno and Penn State, that puts him somewhere or has someone telling him something.
And that's what's most important, is to get that established. Well, on this show, we're always about establishing more light than heat. I think we did that here tonight. Ken Palmer, Giant Insider, and with you, our good friend Steve Callis of WVOX, WFAN, SNY, and the Sports Talk Network. Steve, always a pleasure, my friend. Can't wait to do it again with you here in the FDH Lounge.
Same here, Rick. Always good to speak with you. Have a good night.
Thanks. Same to you, my friend. And we want to thank everybody for tuning in here. Another great episode with our guests here, the FDH Lounge. You can follow us at thefdhlounge.com.